Seuraavaksi jatketaan suoraan seuraavaan puhujaan, eli meidän ensimmäinen keynote-puheenvuoro Yorkin yliopistolta, tutkija ja tohtori Paul Fox from University of York. Welcome.
Okay, thank you. I'm obviously going to speak in English, and I hope everybody can understand. And if you don't, please tell me. We're running a little bit late. Do you want me to finish exactly on time and speak a bit more quickly, or? Okay, we can go so on. I really enjoyed Lena's piece. I didn't understand what she said, but I read your papers in great detail. And there's, of course, some great overlap with what I'm going to talk about, which is this. And I'm going to try not to mention any temples at Palmyra at all, if I possibly can, for reasons that will become obvious to me. But before I do that, maybe I should say that I'm an art historian by training, and I have work on the way that war is represented in European visual cultures. And before I did that, I was in the army for 27 years, and I was an intelligence officer, and I served around the Middle East and elsewhere. So I have one foot in a military camp and the other foot in academia, and it's academia that leads, I guess. But before I do that, and maybe picking up a bit on what Lena was talking about, yesterday some of your colleagues, the students here, some of your colleagues entertained me for dinner last night. And at the end of it, they said, do you want to go and walk around town? We can go and look at the town. I thought, okay, cultural property, right? And what about some intangible cultural heritage? You're going to tell me stories about the place that you work in. So let me ask the audience here, right? This is a seminar interactive thing now. Which building do you think your colleagues took me to as an exemplary building of this city? You have to come back and tell me. Nominate a building. Which building in this city did they take me to and say, this is what this city is about? Any ideas? Some old architecture? What about that? Did make me smile. No, actually, I'm cheating because I don't want to embarrass anybody. It's English humor, this, right? We went past the tattoo shop, and I thought, yeah, that's really cool, even here, right, this tattoo parlor. But no, this is where your friends took me to, which, opened up their world to me a little bit about how they reference their own lives in relation to cultural property. And I particularly enjoyed this, if this thing works, this here, right, where below the tower on top of the hill, there is an anti-aircraft weapon. And so in the city, this cultural property is used to express the relationship between culture and war, which is a slight aside. So I'm going to talk about two things today, I hope. I'll say some introductory things about the Blue Shield, and then talk about now and whether what is happening in the world today is any different from what has happened to cultural property before. And the slides that I'm using, most of them have been made up by an initiative by UNESCO, who commissioned the Blue Shield in the UK to produce training materials for soldiers around the world to educate them about what cultural property and what cultural heritage is, which is an incredibly difficult challenge to produce teaching materials for all cultures. Whether we can do that or not, I don't know. But the format of the slides, many of them come from this teaching pack, which has yet to be used. So we talk about the Blue Shield, and I want to go through this first half quite quickly, I hope. Some of you will know that the foundation for the work of the Blue Shield is the 1954 Hague Convention, which deals very specifically with cultural property and its protection in the event of armed conflict. So this very specific focus on war. And the convention itself is a reflection of European experience in the Second World War, very much. To the extent that in the mid-90s, when the Balkans experienced that long period, that decade, of conflict associated with the breakup of Yugoslavia, that there was it was deemed necessary to write a second protocol. I know people in this room have been involved in the drafting of that second protocol, that would update the Hague Convention in order to deal with the sort of activity that took place in the Balkans, where yet again cultural property became a lever or a weapon for warring factions who wished to assert their sense of cultural dominance over other peoples. So this is the foundation of what we're talking about. And as you will understand, and very specifically for this particular annual event, that the Blue Shield was originally founded around these four international organizations, including ICOM and the others that you can see listed here. And that they therefore have provided the expertise, the academic and professional expertise, to allow the Blue Shield as a place to discuss and to formulate opinions about the protection of cultural property, how it should go forward. So, since 2014, the organization of the Blue Shield has been slimmed down, modified a little bit, and greater emphasis has been placed on trying to control the activities of the national committees, not in terms of what they do, but of coordinating their activities. And so maybe it's worth just reminding ourselves of what the baseline convention says about cultural property, because this impacts a lot upon what Lena was talking about, where intangible cultural heritage, I think, hangs off the end of this. So we have three slides like this. So here we go. The first slide is about objects, whether you can move them or not, monuments, archaeological sites and buildings, art, manuscripts, books, collections, and archives. No matter who owns them or who made them or where they came from. And secondly, the convention deals with buildings, and very specifically those buildings whose main and effective purpose is to preserve or exhibit, so museums in particular and libraries and depositories of archives. It's interesting actually in the context of what Lena's talking about and the need to create inventories or databases, that somehow there's now, of course, a very intangible aspect to this, that there are places out there in cyberspace that surely also fall into this category. And that wherever these buildings are found in groups, then we have what the convention calls centers. Actually, I don't know if you can see, but in Berlin, those of you who are familiar with Berlin, you see here the Second World War bomb damage on the side of the Pergamon Museum. And just after you can see actually what's happening there is that the Berlin authorities, you can just see they're taking out the bomb damaged stone and they're replacing it. So they're effacing the traces of armed conflict from this cultural center, which is an interesting rhetorical act in its own right, I think. And then finally, and look how it comes down here at number four on the list, the intangible cultural heritage issues, which personally I think need to be much more strongly represented in the work of the Blue Shield, which is one of the reasons why I don't have any images of Palmyra today, because I think we see too much of the object and not enough about how Syrian people use that object or have used that place, that center, in order to express their identity and now to express a sense of what has happened to their communities. And then just to make the point, I think that all of this, of course, is grounded within international humanitarian law, and emphatically so, and not least the fact that what the second protocol does is to make it possible to prosecute individuals as well as organizations. That the second protocol is heavy on the notion that people are liable and that if an individual goes out with the intention of destroying cultural property, then you're committing a war crime. So it sits within the overall umbrella of the of international humanitarian law, which is all about armed conflict and attempts to limit the effects of it and to protect people during armed conflicts. And I'd say protect people immediately afterwards as well as attempts to restrict how people fight. And this issue about how people fight, of course, is very relevant to what's happening in the Middle East at the minute, where the non-state actors are fighting in a way that is new and certainly unconventional for a Western audience. And responding to that is a challenge for the Blue Shield. That the convention is legally binding only for those who have signed up to it. But that being the case, it's nevertheless the declaration that by the UN that the principles have value as an international custom, that it's part of international customary law. So the expectation is that whether you are engaged in armed conflict as part of a state or as part of a non-state acting organization, that you're nevertheless liable to be held liable for how you act in relation to cultural property. One of the interesting things I think about the framework of the convention is that it talks about before war, during war, and after war, after armed conflict, and that the framework for these training materials, and indeed the framework for thinking about Blue Shield activity in general, I think, is framed precisely by this. So what do you do in peacetime? What do you do as a concerned party during the transition to armed conflict, then during the armed conflict? And then what about post-conflict stabilization? And I think this is seems a very obvious thing to say that. But look how currently in Syria, we are in the armed conflict phase, not in the reconstruction phase. And that poses enormous ethical issues, for instance, about who do you think you should talk to about a place like Palmyra? Because legally it belongs to the Assad regime, and in fact there's no access to it without the Assad regime. So to what extent are you implicated in a... Are you actually not only yourself implicated passively, but to what extent can the warring faction actively insinuate you into their warfighting strategy? Because we're not in post-conflict stabilization situation at the minute. What the training materials do is to suggest that its audience should think about seven reasons why it is that cultural property is damaged or destroyed generally outside the context of armed conflict, right? And they're listed there, and I'm hoping they're pretty obvious to this audience. There used to be six, and we've recently added the third one in there, enforced neglect. The idea that a faction can demand that a community ignores a site that is culturally important to them, or prevents access to that site, or makes it difficult to engage with your own cultural property. And then, very specifically in the context of armed conflict, there are these six reasons. And I think one of the spin-offs of what Lena was talking about is that what her initiative is about is helping to plan, I think, I would be right in saying, that creating an inventory of intangible cultural heritage, no less than an inventory of cultural property of objects, allows you to plan in advance such that in the event of conflict, you have a place to start from. And the second one is about stealing. And in fact, I'm actually not at the University of York anymore, but for 2 years I worked on the way that in British culture and British imperial culture and how British military organizations basically helped themselves to cultural property in Egypt and the Sudan in the late 19th century, quite legitimately, quite publicly, quite legally, in a way that was approved of by the military and by the society that stood behind them. And thirdly, this issue of collateral damage, that in war things get damaged. And this is quite a hot issue, because I think one of the things that has changed recently in a Western perception of armed conflict is the sheer difficulty of conducting operations without damaging things. It's in fact impossible. And so recently I was present in the audience when the special rapporteur on this subject was about to, she was going to present at the United Nations the first time, and she rehearsed her paper. And she said to me, she used the phrase in her draft speech, so-called collateral damage, which is a phrase that I come across a lot with people who fundamentally don't understand how military targeting works. And I said to her, you know, the term collateral damage has a basis in law, right? Collateral damage is a military reality. It isn't an excuse for something that shouldn't have happened. And if you ironize it, if you say collateral damage, so-called collateral damage, if you attempt to make light of it in some dark way like that, then you are undermining your own case. Collateral damage will happen. And the challenge is to minimize it and to educate people as to what they should do to minimize it, not to shrug it off as something that militaries do because they're bad people, because that, of course, isn't necessarily the case. What is the case, of course, is a lot of people simply don't know what cultural property looks like in a certain place or what people value. And it's, I think, a lot of cultural property is damaged in war zones because people are ignorant. And there's no reason why they should necessarily know. They require education. Less acceptable, of course, is looting, where there is no excuse. The law is quite clear, and militaries should be absolutely clear about the prohibition on looting. And the other issue related to collateral damage really is deliberate targeting, that targeting the enemy is an act of war, it's a legitimate act of war. And we'll come back to that point. So this is, that's you, that's in red, that's for the museology community here, I guess. And I think this is what Lena's been talking about, and she will tell me very quickly if she thinks I'm wrong, that it's about developing databases that allow you to put your finger on what is important to a society. And we'll come on back to these terms, enhanced and special. Put in place operational plans to protect property. If that is a civil task, then the military have a role to play supporting that. If it's a military task in war, then it's the other way around, that the civilian agencies have a role to play supporting the military. And that it's important to recognize who has the authority and the responsibility for executing this sort of work. And you know, Lena stands now, it's really great that she spoke before me. She stands as a national authority who could speak on behalf of a certain community, I think, of interest. And then there's the vexed issue about assigning some sort of visual marker that says, you know, this is cultural property and we value it. That has had a very problematic past. I mean, in the Balkan Wars, the warring factions were given a list of cultural property produced by academics throughout the area. And the Croat faction took that list and went out and destroyed everything on it that they didn't agree with. So the extent to which you disclose what is on that list, what do you do with that list, is an interesting one. And maybe we talk more about that. And how do you train armed forces to be sufficiently understanding of cultural property heritage issues that they can make informed decisions that will help to minimize damage and help to stabilize a country afterwards? One of the things that I talk to militaries a lot about, or we're starting to talk about them, is this, that there are these lists of these databases of property, and that in accordance with the convention, the second protocol identifies something, what it calls an enhanced value, outstanding universal value in the enhanced category. And the World Heritage Sites, for instance, are top of that list. But below that, there's a second order of list where nation states can declare for themselves what it is that is of national importance. And the creation of that list and its sharing with the militaries is a tremendous challenge. Lena was talking about inventories, and the Blue Shield traditionally talks about lists. And what I have increasingly started to say is that we have to talk about databases, because we need to think about it as a rich data set, not just a list of titles. That's an analog way of thinking about it. And then we have to think about who the customer is in the end. Who's the end user? Because, again, reading Lena's notes there, it's interesting that you set up two categories. And your wiki-based approach, where anybody can post what they think is important to significant to them and their circumstances and their own local culture, is that bottom-up approach. But what happens when you start coming at it top-down? How does a nation-state decide what's important, and how does that link to what Lena's talking about, which is, you know, local aspiration? And there's the problem of perhaps at Palmyra, right? What do local people actually really think? And then very specifically for the military here, talk about levels of protection, because it has been traditionally the case that, for instance, in NATO, they talk about a no-strike list. But legally and realistically, as it were, there's no such thing as no-strike. The law says you can strike any target, anything, including a World Heritage site, if the circumstances warrant it. So you can see the words here in the special category. If a warring faction occupies the site and uses it for military purposes, then the opponent can decide, if the opponent decides that it's necessary, can use military power in a tactical way to remove the enemy threat, which might involve using explosives. And the same is equally true of the enhanced category of site. It's just that if you, as the warring faction, decide that you are going to, you know it's a World Heritage Site, you decide to put your tanks in it. If you do that, that's a war crime. And if you do that, the World Heritage Site is no longer a protected place, if the circumstances demand that that the opponent should remove that threat. And, of course, as you can see on the last bullet point there, that would require sanctioning at, of course, an incredibly high level. And what the law says is it must, the senior military person in the area of operations must personally sanction a strike. But in law, there is no such thing as a no-strike place anywhere in the world. And so this is the vexed issue that the 1999 Second Protocol concentrates on quite hard, very hard, right? Special care must be taken. The issue about how you decide what is a legitimate target, what is a necessary action, what is proportionate. These are very subjective terms. And it's impossible, if you're not there at the time, of course, to really judge what someone has to do. Human life comes first. But nevertheless, what the second protocol does is to put responsible legal pressure on military decision makers and their civilian masters, as it were, puts real pressure on them to make sure that what they do is legal and they can justify it. And so this duty to protect is emphasized very strongly in the second protocol. And I would argue that this is, of course, what, for instance, Daesh are responding to. The sense of value that is embedded in these protocols, this construct of value, is precisely the thing that Daesh recognize is a weak point for the West in particular. That we spell out how much we value this stuff. And thanks to the internet, cultural property has become much more of a lever in war than perhaps was until 20 or 30 years ago. There's also at the bottom point here this vexed issue of the illicit export of property. And there's been a great debate in Britain. I've been to a couple of academic conferences and talking about, you know, is Daesh really making money from the selling of antiquities or not? And what can be done about that? How am I doing? Okay. So that's really the first half, which sets the scene, and I'll quickly go through the second half here. So there's some slides really to think about, I hope. So do we have a new situation here? I don't necessarily think we do. There are people who think, well, has there been a cultural turn in civil military affairs? Iraq, Afghanistan, the need for Western militaries to understand local people in the sort of conflicts that they've been involved in. Well, I've been employed for 6 years teaching militaries, British military officers, what is culture? And for a while, you know, I was teaching UK militaries, what is Afghan culture? Or more to the point, what is Pashtun culture? So has there been a cultural turn? Has there been a greater sort of fusion between academia and militaries as a result of that? I think there probably has. But I don't know how new it is. I mean, in the Second World War, you know, they very famously in Western European culture, there's this recently revived understanding about what the monuments men did during the stabilization phase at the end of the Second World War in attempting to literally stabilize the situation and locate and make good cultural property so that it could be restituted properly. And I'm sure that, you know, Finland has its own experience of that, and I'm sure it's a different one from Western Europe. I think what's interesting about then is that it was done by people who culturally came from the same, you know, broadly the same background, sort of Western European background. And I include America at the time in that. I don't think there wasn't a cultural divide, if you like, between the actors in that period. But look how it's interesting. Jeffrey Mertz has written very interestingly about the German War Art Collection. America took 7,200 art objects with it back to America in 1946, 47, illegally, right? Illegally took 7,100 art objects that belonged either to German state institutions or private individuals and took them all back to the United States. And there they stayed until the time when the United States wanted to persuade Germany to allow it to put tactical nuclear weapons on German territory. And all of a sudden, America decides, hey, do you want this art back? Yeah, you can have this art back as part of the defense diplomacy that took place. Except that it didn't quite, because very controversially in the Pentagon today, on the wall, and I've seen some of them in the past, there are 450 works of art that belonged to Germans and that were illegally exported to America in 1948, and they're still there, and they're not coming back. The US military lawyers have suggested that they are in breach of the 1970 UNESCO Convention, and the US military lawyers' response is, oh, well, these oil paintings are not art because they were used for militaristic purposes. So there's nothing kind of new about this, and I don't think anything's really changed. Interestingly enough, there's a tremendous focus on antiquities at the minute, but I think architecture is also an under considered issue. But during the Balkan Wars, a lot of modernist architecture was destroyed in the former Yugoslavia, including this renowned example of modernist architecture, which remains as a ruin in Belgrade, very specifically because it, in terms of intangible cultural heritage, is now a focal point. It's now a lever around the way that Serbs can tell stories about their recent past and their sense of victimhood at the hands of NATO. This is an interesting question. Is it ethical to weaponize culture? That's the last military course I taught. That's just a few weeks ago. And I asked those guys there. There's about 20 people there. They're all seniorish soldiers, most of them. Two or three tours in Afghanistan, two or three tours in Iraq. They've seen more combat than my generation ever did. And if I'd asked that question 5 years ago, is it ethical to weaponize culture? And the answer might have been 50-50. And last month, the answer is almost unanimously, definitely yes. So for them, culture is a lever, not in a sinister way. Because what they perceive is that factions like Daesh know how to manipulate culture incredibly well. And so if they do it, then we need to do it as well. Just out of interest, this is the final exercise for my week-long course. It takes them all day to do this, and the exercise itself, look, is only 4 lines long. It's about cultural property, and it's about intangible cultural heritage. And, of course, there is no answer. You cannot get to a military solution to this. The answer is you've got to engage with local people and then make up your own decision. Make your own mind up. So maybe there's a question, you know, for this audience as well. So during stabilization operations after an armed conflict, would you personally actively support military operations to disrupt illegal trafficking or locate the looted contents of your museum? Because if you do that, you can only do it by going inside the military. And one of the issues that I confront with my cultural specialists is that they try very hard not to describe them as intelligence officers. But are you an intelligence officer? If you create a database of stuff that allows you to understand how a society works, how it's knitted together, how an illicit arms route functions with vehicles and fuel, and communications and a marketplace and couriers and security. Do you need to work like an intelligence officer to be a cultural property actor in this world? And for me, the answer is very clear, you do. Of course, whether you want to call yourself an intelligence officer is neither here nor there. But there are those who have claimed that there should be no embedded academics in the military at all. There's a guy called Hamilakis. Anyone familiar with Hamilakis's work? A Greek archaeologist who thinks that I'm the devil, right? I mean, really. He thinks that the fact that I'm prepared to stand up as an academic in front of militaries and teach them what culture is, but not only what culture is, but how to engage with it, in an adversarial world about winning and losing, right? Because it is an adversarial world about winning and losing. He thinks that's unethical. That he thinks that people like me who were involved in the Iraq War, for instance, added legitimacy to the invasion, academic legitimacy. This wider issue here at the bottom he also makes about this crisis, about, you know, whether we're too object-focused. But just look how well the Syrian regime, the Assad regime, manipulated this. I don't know if you watched it on the news. I mean, Daesh were masters at understanding that if you want to hurt the West, blow up a temple, because they love that stuff. And the only people that did it better was the Syrian regime, except it wasn't the Syrian regime, of course, it was Russia, surely. No one does propaganda better. And what I thought was very interesting was that on the day after the, you know, the word recapture is so value-laden. The recapture of the site by the legally constituted armed forces of a legitimate regime, which is the Assad regime. The recapture of the site was first of all screened on television in the West, showing fighters. But within 24 hours, you saw middle-aged senior officers in the Syrian army talking the language of stabilization, talking the language of reconstruction. And therefore, to engage with this project is to engage with that Russian-backed propaganda operations that have proved to be, I think, incredibly effective. And that's new, I think. I think that's new. I think culture is right up at the front there, and the protection of cultural property in particular. That cultural sensibilities, and by that I mean, you know, not least our cultural sensibilities, are a lever in armed conflict like there's never been before. And because it's about armed conflict, you either win or lose. You can't come second. And this kind of reporting, for instance, here in the Catholic Herald in Britain, is the kind of reporting that encouraged Daesh, because it bleeds. It's painful. They destroy our monastery and it hurts us. Okay. That's leverage. Who has a voice? I'm quite new to this scene with the Blue Shield, and what I have found myself in the UK surrounded by archaeologists, and it's fabulous. They're great. And I have found myself surrounded by relatively few architects, art historians, curators, conservators. And there's some interesting academic writing about the relative interest in the West between the Baghdad Museum, for instance, in 2003 with its antiquities, and the National Museum of Modern Art, which received virtually no coverage and no post-war stabilization support. That whatever we do, we bring with us our own value set, and some things fall off the bottom potentially. Okay, so we've talked about before conflict, during conflict, and after conflict. This is what Hamilaki says, and I agree with this, that since then, and in fact, it's not 2003 anymore, it's what's happening in Syria today, that forces us, I think, to think about the ethical and political dimensions of what we're doing. Because we are, like it or not, sucked into a conflict situation if we discuss today and what will happen when we stabilize or Syria stabilizes its situation. One of the things that's interesting is that Hamilakis actually would think that what I'm doing today is it's okay for me, I guess, as an academic, but he wouldn't like me doing it. But he loathes the idea that you might invite serving military people to a conference. As if the military were another stakeholder, shares the ethics and values of scholarly work. Well, I think they are. Okay, there's another point to discuss, really. And I think what he misses is this point that responsible militaries don't go out to rescue antiquities. They don't, in the end, care about antiquities. They strive to win armed conflict. That's their job. And to survive. And to inflict as little damage as possible. And that perhaps to remember, of course, that in the modern era, in the West anyway, military academies are universities. To become a middle-ranking staff officer, you go on a course that earns you a master's degree. In Britain and America and in Finland, I don't know. A couple of weeks' time in the UK at Cranfield University at the Defence Academy. We're running there's going to be a three-day conference. The Blue Shield is going to speak. Developing strands in the culture of conflict. Half the audience will be military, half the audience will be academic. Just out of interest, that's the course I teach at UCL in the History of Art Department, Modernity and the Representation of Armed Conflict. And for all you undergrads here, okay, there's an essay question from the very last essay for the third year students, one of the choice of six essays. Should art historians and museum professionals participate in the planning and execution of military operations? 3 years ago, when there was a question like that, one person answered it. This year, 50% of the class answered it. And two students told me it was the most interesting thing they had researched on their degree. That's where cultural property is today, I think. How am I doing? I've only got 2 minutes, really. Let me just focus a little bit on targeting. There's two things. During the conflict itself, on targeting, and this notion that the production of databases does is to allow you to feed that database into the military database, and the military database informs where bombs are dropped. And if you don't produce a database in the right format, or you choose not to submit your data to the military, then you won't have the same effect to try and prevent. So this is a classic NATO format for a target set. And in this particular case, the collateral risk is low and the nearest civilian object is a kilometre away. What happens if there's an ancient site there? What does that say about the judgment about collateral damage? Judgment about vulnerability of objects in the vicinity? It changes the whole ballpark, and getting militaries to understand how a database like Lena's is constructed and why it's important, what is valued, how it works, and getting that data and drawing it into the military system is a challenge. Okay. Some of you may be aware that during the Libyan campaign there was a success in this respect, that one of the warring factions in Libya sighted an anti-aircraft battery, not unlike the one up on the hill here, actually, around this Roman fort, deliberately thinking that NATO would not strike a Roman fort. And NATO didn't, because when the targeting staff went to plan the mission to drop the bombs, the database said, no, a Roman fort at this location is a Roman fort. And so the targeters found another way of attacking the vehicles that didn't damage the Roman fort, which attracted a lot of very favourable commentary in the archaeology community. Okay, so these are the UNESCO training materials, most of there, just to finish up. This is the mission. This is the mission of the aim of the training package, to help plan and execute military tasks, lines of operation. And when you plan and execute lines of operation, you're always upholding human rights, especially in respect of CP and CH. And in the process of doing so, that you have the convention in your pocket, you recognize the existence of the convention, you apply it. Let's see. I'll just maybe show you this, because you guys are for museologists. It's a three-day course. The first 2 days is like this, seminar-based type thing. The third day is practical exercise. The first one is a tabletop. Second one is they go on the ground, if we can find. And I wrote this part of the course. For me, it's all about museums, right? So we have this situation where in a stabilization environment, it's not a stabilization environment, an emerging conflict where a terrorist organization is destroying cultural property. You're in the military headquarters. You're the cultural specialist. And you decide that the most vulnerable target in the area is the regional museum. So what do you as a military officer with responsibility for helping to protect cultural property, what do? And in this scenario, you decide that you're going to conduct a visit to the museum. And you have to decide who you're going to speak to when you get there, right? Is it there, does it say? Yeah, maybe not. But who works in a museum, right? Who, if you're there in uniform and you patrol there under threat from the enemy and you turn up and you're the cultural specialist with perhaps an interpreter, who can you expect? What is a museum? How does it work? That's what it's about. Here we are. Ideally, you'll get the chance to ask questions of the CP professionals, director, conservator, curator, security. Work out of what you understand the situation to be to help to inform how you make a decision about protecting cultural property. So what this course does, and it's time to finish, what this course does is to close the gap between militaries and academia and museum professionals. That I think this is a course for both. On my ideal course, there would be members of your community doing the same course, doing exactly the same course, learning about the military, and the military learn about culture professionals. Okay, I've truncated it slightly, but there we are. Thank you.
Any questions for? Yeah, sure.
It must be time. It must be time for a break.
I guess, yeah. Pidetään.
Just a small comment from the intangible side and from the national side, and I think with intangible cultural heritage, it's interesting when people leave now their countries and they go all over Europe, and I think it's around 30,000 refugees we've got to Finland since the beginning of the real flood, is that they take away their intangible cultural heritage with them when they come here. And it's really interesting to see what kind of movements does it affect here. And for example, with our discussions with the Finnish with the folk music groups and people here in Finland and with various actors, that it's interesting that they first thought of that, it's quite well for us here in Finland and there are not that much trouble in that we need to safeguard this or that, but now it's actually the field is changing in this respect. And many of those who used to work with traditional music, they also now have connections, well, both with the immigrants that has been happening before, but also with the refugees. And for example, in Finnish Arts Council, there is this certain kind of artist, Lan in Taiteilija, which all of you know, who specializes in culturally diverse arts and is particularly looking at projects. And I know that many museums are working with this issue as well. So what does it mean when their intangible cultural heritage comes to Finland and is then actually part of our culture? And what kind of cooperation does it then affect on what will at some point be seen, perhaps even in our wiki. So that kind of issues, it comes to be part of ours.
Yeah, it's a very interesting point. One of the things that we've tried to do in Britain is to get people from minority cultural backgrounds to participate in military activity. And it proves very difficult. Individuals are reluctant to do it because of the criticism they receive from inside their communities. However, recently, Britain put a young soldier who's Syrian. he has been put on the ships picking up the refugees because the refugees are too scared to tell you who the people traffickers are. And he spent 48 hours with Syrians on board a ship speaking their language, their cultural language. And when that ship got to Cyprus, they arrested 15 people traffickers, one of whom was also implicated. He had cultural property in a bag.
Thanks, Paul. Excellent presentation with deep understanding of three kinds. I think it's about balancing the understanding of local views and military understanding, and thirdly about world heritage. And I think you showed it quite nicely how difficult it is sometimes to balance all these things. So that's more like a comment. And then what about those drawings? I loved your drawings.
You like those drawings?
Yes.
Raise your hand if you like the drawings. Because I have to tell you, Peter Stone, who's in charge of the project, he said to me, right, Paul, I found you. You're the art historian who used to be a soldier. You found me someone who used to be a teacher in the army. Now he's doing the training materials with you. And he said, but now we need an artist. And I said to him, Peter, my son is a wonderful graphic artist. And so those are my son's, that's my son's work. He works, have you heard of Aardman, who do a lot of, Aardman do a lot of films, animated films in Britain.
Yes.
And he works on film, feature films, as a storyboard artist. And even as we speak today, he's making more of these, so thank you.
You mean the Wallace and Gromit studio?
Well, Wallace and Gromit is Aardman.
Oh, wow.
Right. So,
well, congratulations, those are wonderful.
And what I want him to do, which will please Lena, I hope, is that it's easy to do for him to do, to represent physical objects, which, of course, is, I think, the challenge for the Blue Shield. I think dealing with artifacts is just an object-focused inquiry is so easy relative to dealing with the intangible. And today he's going to draw me a picture of a storyteller. In some way, you know, in the way, and that people are imparting their cultural values in non-tangible ways, and for him, that's today's challenge. Yeah, thank you.
All right, thanks.